What?
Todd, relax. With this huge inventory and screaming good deals, they won't last long. I mean, where else can you drive two of the best trucks on the market with no pushy salesmen?
You make a great point. Our salesmen are knowledgeable, professional, and not pushy.
That's why our sales have grown over 40% this year. Great products, great deals, and great people.
Don't forget our huge inventory.
G-Stone Motors has been family-owned and operated for 40 years. We invite you to join the G-Stone family today.
G-Stone Motors, Route 7 in Middlebury, or online at gstonemotors.com.
It's time to get the story behind the story. Interviews with newsmakers, newsbreakers, and your phone calls. Radio Vermont presents The Mark Johnson Show.
I'm sorry, I'll be with you in just a moment here. I'm just giving Andy Polito directions to the tailor shop in Stowe's Lower Village. He needs to get a couple of clothing items taken care of. So I'll introduce the program here in just a second. It's right on Route 100, just past the Shell station, next driveway. Welcome to the program, everybody. Thank you very much for joining us. What a beautiful day today. If you happen to catch that sunrise this morning, I would have to say that was one of the top 10 of the year. It was somewhere between pink, red, and orange. And wow, that was a keeper. Thank you for joining us on the program this morning. We're going to get down to business in just a moment here. We're going to talk with the corrections commissioner, quite spiffily dressed. And later this hour, we're actually going to check in with the folks at Velco, who have an announcement that they're going to be making later today. We'd love to hear from you this morning. You can join us at 244-1777. That's our local number in central Vermont. Toll-free 877-291-8255. All right, I'm not going to mention that it's your birthday today.
Please.
Thanks for joining us. How are you this morning, Commissioner Polito?
Very good. Thank you, by the way.
So the reason that I asked you to come in here, I think, is the reason a lot of people want to talk to you these days about the correctional system. I want to talk about the placement of correctional prisoners out of state. But, you know, actually, the first thing I want to ask you about, given what's going on around the world here with Ebola and these infectious diseases, what does the correction department do? You know, we're not probably going to have Ebola, but you might have the flu or something else. How do you deal with isolating prisoners and keeping everybody from getting sick?
It's a great question. Yesterday I was in St. Albans and touring the facility, and of course we had somebody in the facility who has strep. And when somebody comes into a facility with strep, the flu, or any of those other types of things that spread relatively easily, we have a protocol that we go through. And it includes informing staff about hand washing, how we put people away from the rest of the population. So we have to do something that keeps separation. I don't want to call it isolation because that's unfair, but it is a separation from the rest of the population. Yesterday we issued guidelines to the entire department about dealing with flu, not only in the institutions, but also in the community, because our staff, if we have a flu outbreak in a probation and parole office and half the staff goes out on sick leave, it's problematic. And so we issue guidance. It goes to all staff on protocols that we follow. And then if you see something, what to do with it. And so what to do with an individual that comes in. We have about 7,000 or 8,000 individual people that come in and out of a jail in a given year. So with our static population, it equals quite a number of people coming in and out of institutions, and some of them bear a much higher burden than others. So Chittenden, for instance, sees thousands of people coming in and out, plus people that are incapacitated. And so the likelihood that common things like the flu or strep will be spread is pretty high. So we have protocols. We work at the health department and our medical staff to find out what best practice is and follow it.
Do you have enough room to separate prisoners who are sick?
We do. Depending. So if we have, I think the last strep outbreak we had was a couple of years ago. If we have a bunch of people that are showing strep symptoms, we'll put them in one unit so they're all kind of together. But if it's an individual or two, we usually put them into a cell away from the rest of the population and keep them where we can observe them, treat them until the medical staff decide that he's no longer spreading the disease. Because, you know, once you get certain parts, it's not spreadable. So they do put people out to places in the institution where they don't interchange with the kitchen staff and all those types of things.
Is it in isolation? Is it where you would go if you were bad? Same place?
It's basically the same place, but you have a lot more individual freedom. So when you when you pick up a disciplinary that results in separation, you lose a lot of your property rights. You lose a lot of, there's a lot of other things that happen. Somebody who's sick doesn't go through that.
Right.
So there are differences.
So you're not penalized, in other words, for being sick.
That's right. That's right.
Did you have a flu outbreak last year?
We do have people who come in every year who have the flu. We don't have outbreaks necessarily in any given year. I don't remember a large flu outbreak. It seems like we've had, I can't really recall to be truthful, but individual institutions that may have handfuls or two of people with strep, usually once we identify it, we can contain it pretty quickly. We haven't had an entire institution with the strep, for instance. I can't remember. Uh-huh. I don't think we have.
But. Okay. We're talking with the Corrections Commissioner, Andy Pulido. You can join us at 244-1777. That's our local number. Toll-free, 877-291-8255. Total prison population today?
Is about 2,050 individuals, 80 individuals, somewhere in that range.
How many out of state?
We have 475 individuals out of state.
So the prison population has grown significantly in the past 10, 15 years.
Right. So in the 90s, it grew quite a lot and resulted in the department housing people in New Jersey originally, then Virginia, and then ultimately to Kentucky, where they are now, Kentucky and Arizona. The population's dropped off a bit. So we were over 2,300, so we're down 10% since the high in around 2005 and 6. And it's kind of stagnated for me, you know, for the current period. Now, we have some initiatives that I think will lead to an ultimate decline in the facility population, but right now we're running about 2,050. The 475 that are out of state are all sentenced, and so that creates a little bit of a wrinkle in that we can only send sentenced people out of state. Of the 2,050 people, about 400 are detained. We cannot send a detentioner out of state, so it's a little bit of a balancing act.
And when you say detained, you're talking pretrial?
Pretrial, correct.
Is that a higher number than normal? That sounds really high.
You know, it's fluctuated. It's lower than it was in the recent past. It was over 400, 450 for a while, 470. It's down around 380, give or take. So it's off a bit. But historically, it's pretty stagnant in the mid-300s. We were down as low as low 300 for a little while, but you know, it's based on crimes, court activity, so on and so forth.
Is that a group of people that needs less supervision, less attention?
Well, you know, we have a pretrial initiative right now. It grew out of S-295 in the legislature. It's a group of people that we don't know a whole lot about. So they come to the Department of Corrections when they're detained. They're in that pretrial mode. They may have issues of substance abuse predominantly and other issues that are leading to their criminal activity. We don't have a chance really to work with them because they're pretrial. Mm-hmm. And so they're not really, they're in the DOC's custody, but they're not with us for service or for treatment or anything other things. They're simply with us for holding while they wait their adjudication. And so It's unmet. They have an unmet need, but they're in that pretrial category. Now, we have 295, which is our pretrial services. We just hired a new person to oversee pretrial. I think through that effort, we'll start to expand our ability to deal with people that are pretrial, get at their root causes of their criminality, and then perhaps deflect them from going deeper in, certainly deflect them from coming into the corrections custody, and so maybe start to see a further decline of their overall 2050. That's probably at least a year out, though.
Mm-hmm.
We have to build this entire thing. We don't have pretrial services, really, in Vermont right now. We're building this thing from scratch. So.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Andy Pulido, the Corrections Commissioner. We'll take a quick break. We'll get back to our discussion right after this.
Formula Nissan in Barrie is the fastest growing Nissan dealer in Vermont. And Vice President Jack Castellaneta says people are driving from Burlington, Lebanon, even St. Jay to save up to $6,700 off the MSRP of new Nissans. Jack, what's the catch?
There's no catch. It's just one of the ways we make it easy to do business here. A better selection of new Nissans, huge savings you won't find anywhere else, and pricing that nobody can touch.
No crazy fine print. Formula Nissan cuts the baloney and saves you money.
We're keeping it's simple, and simpler means cheaper. Don't make a $3,000, $4,000, or even $6,000 mistake somewhere else. Get more for your trade and huge discounts direct from the factory at Formula Nissan.
0% financing up to 60 months. Huge factory discounts and rebates that make it simple to drive a new Nissan. But it all ends October 31st.
Only at Formula Nissan on the Barrie Montpelier Road next to Pizza Hut and at FormulaNissan.com. Let us show you how easy it is to do business here.
On approved credit, offer ends 10/31/14.
RB Technologies on Route 14 in East Montpelier has been creating and supporting thoughtfully designed, custom-crafted computer networks for their clients since 1997. Here's Rob Weiss from the Central Vermont Council on Aging.
I went to RB Technologies because I was looking for a migration from our older technology server to a newer technology, but I went to a number of different companies. I settled on RB Technologies because they are local. I didn't feel talked down to, which was really important. With RB Technologies, you get a feeling that they're really there to help you. They're not there to like try to sell you something that you don't need. They're there to listen to you, and they'll make recommendations, and they won't do anything without asking about if that's what you want to do, and I found that to be invaluable.
RB Technologies cares about their customers. Online at rbtechvt.com. RB Technologies. Efficiency through technology.
Matt, continuing our discussion, we've been talking this morning with the Corrections Commissioner, Andy Polito. You can join us at 244-1777 is our local number, toll-free 877-291-8255. We were just talking about the size of the prison population, and we're going to talk a little bit about the out-of-state contract that the state has to house some 475 prisoners. So there's 2,000 in Vermont, 475 out of state, or 2,000 total, and then 1,500 in Vermont.
Yeah, that's right. I'm going to round this a little bit, but we have about 150 women, about 1,900 men, of which of the 1,900 men, 475 are housed out of state. So it's a total of 2,050. Number fluctuates anywhere between 2,050, 2,100. Obviously, we see a lot more activity on the weekends, and so the number will come up. And there's some seasonality to it, court activity. All those things play into the population overall because we're a jail and detention population in Vermont.
When's the seasonal part of it?
Well, so depending on court activity, sometimes they get backed up. Sometimes there's an increase in vacations, for instance, around the holidays. And so the population can be affected by that a little bit. And then it seems as though detention fluctuates, you know, down in the summers, up in the fall, down around the holidays, up in the winter. It's there isn't really a lot of pattern that you can put to it, but it's in general terms, there's seasonal fluctuation.
What, do you have any clue why that happens?
No, it's there's a lot of theories, particularly in the Department of Corrections, but nothing that really seems to make any real sense. And the numbers aren't huge. We're not going from 200 to 400. They're fluctuating by 30 or 40 people.
Okay. All right. Let's go to Cabot. Tony, good morning.
Good morning. I have a question, and I'm hoping that maybe Mr. Polito can kind of tease some of this out for me. So I understand that a number of people who are incarcerated are there for drug problems, and I assume by that you mean possession or sales. And then there's a portion of the same population who have drug problems who've committed some sort of felony offense that got them in there. The cause of it might have been a need to supply themselves with drugs, but there was some act that ended up getting them convicted. So first question is, do you have an idea of what the numbers look like relative to those two groups or percentages?
So I'm going to be very generous with rounding on this, so I don't have exact numbers, but I can give you just a general sense. You're caller's right in that there are certain crimes that come up as a result of somebody who is using DUIs in excess of three, for instance, so four or five through all the way up. Some domestic violence issues, simple assault, issues with law enforcement. So all those things that are related to having a substance abuse issue that lead to a crime, breaking and entering, property crimes. The estimates are 70 to 80% of the overall population, so of that 2,050, have a substance abuse issue. So they are actively engaged in substances that lead to an arrest or so on and so forth. So that's quite a high number. The ones that are actually in jail related to possession and dealing are actually not as big. They're much, much, much smaller. And I don't have a good sense. I would say it's probably less than 10% or about 10% of our overall population are engaged in actual dealing and so on and so forth.
I understand, and that's very helpful. So that if the, I think you said around 78 or 80% have engaged in those behaviors that end up getting them incarcerated. And so, yeah, we hope that we're hoping or assuming that treatment is going to short-circuit that loop that gets them involved in the future with actions that get them incarcerated. But in the meantime, I just wanted to say that I appreciate the fact that you guys are helping to protect those of us on the outside from those that choose those behaviors or are led into those behaviors that seek to prey on those of us who are outside. So my thanks to you for doing that.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. You know, one of the things I would say is the target population in all these conversations at the state level are about the people that are using, and that should obviously decrease their need to commit crimes and also decrease the drug traffic because it's a supply and demand piece. Bottom line, we want to bring down our overall recidivism rate and the number of people that are coming into jail so communities are safer, corrections costs go down, but the overall crime rate also goes down. So it's kind of a win-win-win, but it's a complicated win-win-win. That's kind of why we're here, because it is so complicated.
I appreciate your efforts. Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Tony. 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255. I just want to pick up something from his call here. If the state of Vermont were to legalize marijuana, how many fewer people would you have in jail?
So we've looked at this issue, and the number of people that are actually in jail where possession of marijuana was their highest level of crime is very small. It's less than a handful of people. A lot of people get picked up on other things that include possession of marijuana or marijuana utilization. So it won't necessarily lead to a decrease in the incarcerated population. It will likely lead to a decrease in some of our probation cases and whatnot. Again, it's not a huge number, but it's a piece of the overall puzzle.
Back to this number of in-state and out-of-state. You know, maybe this is just incredibly naive, but it seems as though if you built one facility for the people that were being detained, that you would then have room to put all the people that are out-of-state back here in Vermont.
Yeah, so, you know, it's complicated because I say that about everything in corrections, but
why can't it be as easy as I just described?
Right. So the overall operating costs of the out-of-state program are in the order of magnitude of $10 or $12 million. That's what it costs to house 475 people out-of-state, $10 to $12 million per year. If we build a facility in-state, it increases the likelihood that we can work with those people, they have better connections to their family, better connections to their community. All those things are positive. When you get to the funding part, likely the costs will be a little bit higher in Vermont. So the $10 to $12 million will go up a little bit. But the building cost to build 500 beds has been estimated at anywhere between $100,000 and $200,000 per bed. Right. I could see by the way you roll your eyes. So you're...
Wow.
When we built Springfield for 350 people, that cost, and that was back in 2000 through 2003, the cost came in at around $30 to $35 million. So it was just about $100,000 per bed. Now, 15 years later, 14 years later, we're probably higher than the $100,000. You're easily at $50 million and possibly more than that. I think there is an opportunity, though, working on the pretrial piece that I mentioned, plus the DOC just received a $3 million grant recidivism grant from the Bureau of Justice. And what they're really looking for us to do is to build a process to release people to decrease their recidivism. They're not looking to build buildings or pay for people to be on the DOC staff for the next 30 years. And so we have to build a process. Between those two efforts and potentially a partnership with the feds, because the marshals have people in their custody, ICE, Immigration and Customs needs beds, so on and so forth, there may be an opportunity to build a smaller facility. They like St. Albans because it's closer to the border, closer to the courts. That conversation's in, like, the first percentage of that conversation, and potentially build something in Vermont that's creative financing. I'm waiting to hear back from the feds to see if that's even possible before I can offer it to the governor's office and say this maybe makes sense. But there may be a potential partnership. Bottom line, though, the capital bill in Vermont, I don't think, can sustain a $50 to $100 million new correctional facility.
Mm-hmm.
So,
if you had your way, would you have everybody housed in Vermont, or is this a non-issue?
If I had my way, I'd have everybody housed in Vermont. Absolutely. I do think, though, if we're just a patient for just a little bit more to see what 290, what the new pretrial services bill does to the population, and then the substance abuse efforts of the governor's office does to the population, and then the recidivism grant. So in a few more years, see where the population benchmarked, and then at that point start to make some decisions about what we want to do. I don't think having a long-term relationship out of state really is healthy for the state. I don't think it's financially healthy. I don't think it's healthy for our communities. I don't think it's healthy for our population. But I don't want to suggest that we should go out and do something right now because we have a current issue that we need to deal with. I think if we just have a little more patience, it may emerge amongst itself as to what the outcome should be.
You're waiting for bids to come in next week on providing the services for people to be housed out of state.
Right.
How many bids are you expecting to get, Andy?
Well, so, you know, historically we'd get four or five bids, and I'm just going to put the elephant on the table. CCA is the biggest provider. They have been for a number of years. They own a lot of beds out of state. They have a significant influence in the market. So that's part one. Part two is their services are generally fair. When we ask them for something, when we make a demand, they follow up. And then financially, their prices are always pretty competitive. So they're, you know, right now they're in the 60, mid-60 range for Kentucky. It's really hard to compete.
$67 a day per person,
which is pretty financially attractive. I think that's the way I'll say it. And so when the state's dealing with a 5% potential budget decrease and so on and so forth, it's really hard to fantasize about going somewhere else, going to another potential bidder. But everybody knows what we're paying. So we may see in this bid, hopeful, from competitors, state-level corrections institutions, we may see multiple bidders in that price range. And then I'm hoping that we get, four or five competitive bids that we can actually kick the tires on.
Mm-hmm. This question about control of the prisoners once they leave the state, talk to me about that. I mean, it seems as though from recent incidents, this problem that was out in Arizona, there was a bit of a disturbance riot. I'm not sure how you would characterize it. But basically, Corrections Corporation of America was able to institute the punishment that they wanted. And you have really no control.
Well, once we make the decision to send people out of state, we give up a little bit of that control. They are still technically...
A little bit or all of it?
Well, I would say a fair amount. They're still in the custody of the Department of Corrections in Vermont, but they're housed in another state, in another system, and if they go to another state-level system, in another jurisdiction. And so if they have an incident in Kentucky, they're liable to pick up Kentucky charges. And so that really complicates the issue. So when we had the incident in Massachusetts, there were people in that institution that were getting ready to walk out in a few days. They picked up Massachusetts-level charges, and some of them are still sitting in Massachusetts state-level facilities. And so CCA, if there's an incident, there was an incident in Arizona, it's their team that goes in. It's their team that quells the incident. In that case, it was about 10 people who refused to lock in. It only lasted about 20 minutes. Their trained response team goes in. They deploy what they think is necessary. We're basically on the phone getting advised. And then they hand out discipline, their system of discipline, to the guys. And so what we wind up doing is we have caseworkers going down all the time. State spends a fair amount of money sending caseworkers back and forth, which is on top of the $67. And then making sure that we're checking in with the guys, seeing what the penalties are. We have an influence on what their discipline is, but in the end, it's a CCA-level discipline system.
You comfortable with that?
Well, as comfortable as I can be. You know, I am... The department has been asked to house 2,000 inmates in 1,600 beds. And so given the current, that dynamic, the state's appetite for incarceration exceeds its number of beds, bottom line. And every time, frankly, every time we have a legislative session, we have a new crime that comes out of it or a stiffer penalty. And so the appetite to put people in jail far outweighs the ability to house people. And so that's where we are. I'm the fourth corrections commissioner with this dynamic. And so I accept that given that dynamic, I give up a little bit of control on 475 people. I've worked really, really hard to bring that number down. That population was over 600 and cruising to 1,000 a handful of years ago through increased uses of furlough where appropriate. Some of the technologies that have come out have allowed us to release people. All those things, we've been able to manage the population, but we're kind of hitting the bottom end of the decrease here. And so we've been hanging around this 475 number, although that's one of the lowest I've seen it for a few years. And so given that, we're asked to manage it, and I think we do it in the way that we can. So we've staffed it with people that go out and check with our inmates. We handle a lot of mail from inmates. You know, we're doing the best we can with the dynamic.
We're talking with the Corrections Commissioner, Andy Polito. Let's take some calls. We go to Starkesboro. Rich, good morning.
Good morning, Mark. I got a few questions, I guess, or at least a question, maybe some follow-up time, too, maybe if possible. I want to ask about basically the namesake of the Department of Corrections. Can you describe what kind of corrections go on there? I assume by corrections it means a learned change in behavior, at least a striving for a learned change of behavior. I was wondering what kind of programs you have in that area.
So, you know, it's interesting. That name probably, it's a historical name, and it varies by state. I think in Massachusetts it's called the Department of Correction. It's not plural, and so it's something that lives in statute. Some places it's called Department of Rehabilitative Services, and so it depends on the state. But we do offer a fair amount of programs. Sex offender program is probably the one you hear the most about. We offer a program for violence reduction. So if you're convicted of one of the higher levels of violence, aggravated assault, so on and so forth, it's a program specifically for people with levels of violence. That's some examples of the programming we offer.
I'd like to talk more about some things that I think about a lot and probably most prisons don't think about a lot. And I think there ought to be some form of curriculum. Being a retired educator, I'm thinking, you know, why can't we do more in corrections? Like I'm thinking like people learning about financial literacy. You know, there's all kinds of things that people can get out of, you know, graduate from high school and still be lacking in basic life skills. And I would think recidivism would be helpful if people just knew more about how to survive in society and, you know, and knowing how to, do you do anything like that?
Yeah, so we run a very large high school in the state. And so
Rich, thanks for your call. I appreciate it. Go ahead.
Sorry about that. We run a high school in the state. In the Department of Corrections, and we educate a lot of people. We hand out probably almost 100 diplomas, and that number has been dropping because the number of young people coming into the system is on the good side, actually falling. And so in Vermont, our population is aging quite a bit in jail. And so what we've transitioned to is the point you make, which is people can still come out of high school and have some deficits that get in the way of writing a resume or how do you dress for an interview and so on and so forth. So we've transitioned to high school a little bit towards life skills. And so you may know how to read, but you may not know how to write efficiently enough to apply for a job or so on and so forth. And so those are some of the skills that we do teach, and they are directly related to recidivism reduction.
Can you negotiate control over inmates with Corrections Corporation of America?
I'm not sure what that would look like. So they are 700 miles away in Kentucky. And when they are responsible for the safe running of the institution. We do negotiate over staffing levels, for instance. When we had the incidents last fall, we increased staffing. All that comes in cost negotiations, too. And so we managed to make some changes within that institution with their agreement without any increase in cost, really. And so it depends on what we're willing to pay for, what they're willing to do. You know, in the end, CCA is a private company. And they're only in this because it results in a financial gain. And so they need to be made whole on those things. And so depending on where the deficits are, what our request is, and what we're willing to pay for it, yes.
Let's go to Callis. John, good morning.
Good morning, Mark. Good morning, Commissioner Polito. I'm calling you hands-free, happy to say.
Thank you.
Commissioner, I just have a quick question, and I'm running off to a meeting, so I'm probably going to hang up on you guys. My understanding is that there's a prison that the state of New York is going to be closing, and I just had some thoughts that, you know, first, I'm wondering if that's on your radar, and secondly, if that was something you might want to think about as an alternative to Kentucky, could Vermont lease it from New York, maybe with an eye toward purchase if the finances work out going forward?
Wow.
It would seem that would be, it's just across the lake in terms of your caseworkers that could drive there, I would expect after a long day, they could get there and back. It might be, you call a few things win-wins. It might be a win-win for Vermont and New York State. I don't know.
So New York State is on our radar. A lot of states have state law that say you cannot accept out-of-state prisoners, and New York was one of them historically. I don't know if that's changed. I don't think it has. But New York is on our radar, and we have reached out to them directly through this bidding process. But historically, state-level DOC facilities in New York were kind of off the table. I have actually reached out directly to their commissioner at one point, and he told me they weren't interested, so on and so forth. So we do.
Where's the facility?
The facility that I think it's called Owl's Head. I'm not 100% sure. I think it's called Owl's Head. It's right at the base of Owl's Head Mountain, which is west of Plattsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the one that the caller was talking about. And so there's another one that.
Why don't you just buy it and then it's under your control?
Well, because again, if there's state laws that say you cannot bring in prisoners from other states, that gets in the way. So it's a protection against.
Right.
So here's what could potentially happen. We could allow state-level prisoners from other states come into Vermont if we had room, and then they could reenter here. That was the fear of a lot of states historically, and so that was precluded in a lot of states. And New York, like I said, was one of them. And so there's also an institution down on the southern part of the lake crossed from Route 4, where Route 4 kind of goes into New York, that we entertained, but there were some preclusions there, too. I do think, though...
Can't use Fort Ticonderoga.
No. I do think during this process, we have reached out to them as well and said...
And I wonder what New York's going to do with, you know, how they're going to reuse this facility.
They have a few facilities that they... So a lot of states during the 90s built,
right.
And now they're in a position where they have empty spaces.
Right.
We didn't do that in Vermont. And so as a result, we don't have facilities that are half empty or we're closing down. I know there's some significant pressures between the DOC in New York State and the Correction Officers Union because facilities are being run less than capacity, and so it's been going on for a while.
Mm-hmm. Is there any other company besides Corrections Corporation of America that you expect is actually going to be competitive next week?
Competitive is in the eye of the beholder. There are a couple other companies that operate down south. I think one is called the Geo Group. Some of them are out of Florida. Distance has to be a part of this consideration. But again, they are small, very small in comparison to CCA, and that creates the pressure that CCA and frankly the influence that CCA has also translates into their per diem. Now, I'll know better in a week's time exactly what the landscape looks like, but I don't know if the landscape has changed much. I don't think it has in the last 4 years.
Last area I wanted to ask you about is this pre-trial, what you're doing in this pre-trial initiative. You somehow managed to talk Annie Ramsenu from Spectrum into joining you. Congratulations on that. So what are you hoping to get? What's the best case scenario outcome out of this is what?
Best case scenario is that people that come into the court system that have a substance abuse issue are diverted. If the substance abuse issue, if the indications are that when you treat the substance abuse issue, the criminal need goes away, they're diverted out of the system. That doesn't mean they get away without anything. That just means that we treat the underlying cause, it decreases their risk to reoffend, and they're diverted out of the Department of Corrections altogether. That's best case scenarios. But as I mentioned, the system starts taking cases on next October. We got to build this thing. And Annie's doing a wonderful job, but we're still in the infant stages. And then it'll be a while before we can actually see whether or not it's successful. It's really prototyped off of TJ Donovan's program. And
yeah,
it's different population, but that's kind of the prototype.
Mm-hmm. What are you going to be looking for from the legislature this year? You got a 5% reduction. So how are you doing with a 5% reduction?
So I've been doing this a long time. And so our 5% reductions generally have been small cuts to contracts or grants. We haven't actually, even in the recidivism, in the rescission, we haven't actually been asked to take a big cut. I think the governor's office understands that cutting the Department of Corrections, we're a human services organization. We have a lot of staff, and cutting staff doesn't make a lot of sense. And so we've been treated pretty well. The governor really understands what we have. And so even closing a correctional facility, if we close a correctional facility, the savings is high hundreds of thousands of dollars because you still have the individuals to do something with.
Right.
All you basically do is lay off our staff and hire CCA staff. It doesn't make a lot of sense. And so we haven't been asked to do that. Our budget increases, this is a little bit of a plug, our budget increases over the last 5 or 6 years have been 1%, 1.5%, 2%. They've been really small. And we've been able to expand transitional housing because the population's been dropping, expand transitional housing, expand some of our other initiatives. And so we've added staff in the last 5 years, and so the department has done a pretty good job managing the budget. I'm not sure if in this current budget we'll be asked to actually take a down. Mm-hmm. We've put some stuff on the table that's kind of repetitive of what we've always offered up, cutting caseworkers, but again, that doesn't make any sense. It just clogs people in jail. What I've said to the governor's office is if we give pretrial a little chance to work and we work on this recidivism grant that we just got, the population should really start to decline here in the next handful of years. And then the big savings for me is decreased utilization of the out-of-state program.
Yeah.
If at some point we can shut that down, there's $12 million of general fund
right
going to, I think CCA is a Tennessee corporation, so going somewhere else. So that to me is the real success. Bottom line, though, because the population hasn't exploded or gone to where the original projections were, we're already saving some money in corrections. So I think overall I'm proud of the budget that we've put on the table. I don't know how this next piece will go. The one big piece that we have is the legislature did a study of our overall facility needs, mm-hmm. capital needs. There's like $12 million in immediate capital needs that need to be funded. That's the big piece of corrections news at this point for the legislature. I don't think we have a lot of legislative initiatives. I think Annie may have a few tweaks to pretrial because that bill was put together. She may have a couple things she might want to change, but other than that, I think I'm hoping for a relatively quiet year.
How soon do you need the $10 to $12 million in capital stuff? Yesterday?
That's immediate capital needs. So that's the legislature had BGS do a study. They came in and did a markup of all the capital needs that exist today. So they exist right now.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be hopefully this session or a piece of it this session. I will say that they rated, I think, 6 of our facilities as good and 2 as fair. And the 2 that are fair are the ones that have the largest portion of that capital need.
Mm-hmm.
So
thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Happy birthday. I hope none of your birthday cakes today contain any chisels and that we check for that. That's Andy Pulido. He's the corrections commissioner. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to check in next with Carrick Johnson of Velco. We'll be back right after this.
Hi, everybody.